For more information, please send a message to admin@ckut.ca.
وفي قلوب الدنيا الحرب حين هوت مدينة القدس تراجع الحب وفي قلوب الدنيا استوطنت الحرب الطفل في المغارة
وأمه مريم وجانية
قيان وإنني أصلي
الغضب الصادع
فأنا ذاهبة لأصلي سأدق على الأبواب وسأفتحها الأبواب وستوصل يا نهر الأردن وجهي بمياه قدسية وستمحو يا نهر الأردن أثار القدم الهمجية الغضب الساطع بجياد الرهبة الغضب الساطع بجياد الرهبة وسيهزم وجه القوة سيهزم وجه القوة البيت لنا والقدس لنا البيت لنا والقدس لنا وبأيدينا سنعيد بهاء
You are tuned in to CKUT 90.3 FM in Montreal. This is a special broadcast, Voices for Gaza. I'm hosting today. I'm Stefan Christoph, and I'm sure that some people tuned in to CKUT have been following the major protest and encampment for Palestinian life and against the ongoing Israeli government military attacks on Gaza that has been taking place at McGill University's campus. This is ongoing, so we're going to talk about that. We're also going to talk about the fact that Palestinian journalists have been systemically targeted in the Gaza Strip. And at the same time, this is one of the main sources of information about what's actually happening in Gaza because the Israeli government has banned international media from entering. So there's lots to talk about, and we only have an hour, so we'll get right into it. Of course, we heard from Fairuz to open the broadcast. And I guess I'll just sort of go in a circle. So maybe we'll start with you, Tara. You're from the Palestinian Feminist Collective. Maybe just introduce yourself, and if you could share a bit about why and how this encampment has been important, not only here in Montreal, there's encampments in other places, but has been important to you as a Palestinian organizer, and maybe share some reflections that are important to you that you haven't heard in mainstream media.
Yeah, thanks for having us today. So I'm Tara. I'm from Occupied Jerusalem and Occupied Jaffa. I'm a third generation Palestinian exile and also an organizer with Palestinian Feminist Collective here in Montreal. And so I think right now we're in a moment where the student movement has progressed incredibly over the past 7 months. But I think it's important to understand that this has been building up over the past few years, especially on McGill campus. The encampment, like you mentioned, which is one of hundreds of encampments across North America and also across across other continents, including Europe, Australia, there are some in Asia, comes after several years of provocation from McGill's administration and their refusal to understand the demands of their students to divest from the Israeli colonial war machine and to divest from their involvement, their millions of dollars worth of involvement in the murder of Palestinians and also the occupation of Palestinian land. And so if you contextualize the current encampment in within the history of the past few years, not just on McGill campus, but also in North America, and the level of repression that student organizers have faced, whether it's doxing or threats of expulsion or suspension, or actual physical threats, visits by the FBI, or other federal, you know, law enforcement, then this escalation by the student can be can be understood properly, and I think also the importance of the student movement right now in the larger context of the movement for Palestine shows us that people's resistance consciousness has really been elevated in the past few months, and so whatever you know, is being reported in the media, whether that's allegations of anti-Semitism or quote-unquote violence or now debunked stories about systemic rape on October 7th or otherwise, or 40 beheaded babies in ovens or what have you, is not really having an effect on the people's willingness to stand up against Canadian sanctioned genocide, not just sanctioned but also funded material, like the material investment of this Canadian settler state in the genocide of the Palestinian people and occupation of Palestinian land. And whether the media is reporting this or not has not affected the students' commitment to the escalation or the movement at large, our commitment to Palestinian liberation and to really play the role that we need to play as Palestinians and also co-strugglers here in the imperial core, in the belly of the beast. And so, you know, the sacrifices that the students are making, the repression that they're facing, all of that, I think can be well, you know, understood when we contextualize it within the past few years.
Thank you so much, Tara, for outlining all of that. You used twice the term escalation, and I think that's really important to sort of understand that there's a momentum of what's happening right now, and it's also in some ways unexpected. I mean, for months, all winter, all around the world, people were protesting for Palestine, for Palestinian human rights. When we hear the term escalation, we also, you know, think about intense political campaigning. But Michelle, you've been at the encampment. There is intense political campaigning, but there's also like poetry readings. There's a library. And I think that these are things that maybe some people who are listening might not know about the encampment. So you're a professor that has been supportive of the encampment. So maybe just sort of thinking a little bit more about and sharing anything you'd like to about how this encampment has also been a very important space for like learning within activism and a community building process.
Sure. Well, thanks very much for inviting me to come on. I'm a prof at McGill, and I have been at the encampment every day. And I think that if we see what is going on in the camp as related, as Tara just pointed out, to this larger movement and to the larger movement for the liberation of Palestine, not just now or in the past few years, but over the past, 76 years, even longer, right? It makes so much sense that it is both a strong political escalation and movement, very much in line with a youth-led movement that's been rising for a number of years now, right? So at the same time, yes, we're so excited to see the students coming together and so on, but really the global youth have been rising up for Palestine for a number of years. And what one thing that really impresses me so much about the Palestinian youth movement is how focused those young people are on their education. So when I have been, we see them in the streets and we see them every, week and so on, and that's been very, very powerful and important. But I don't know how many people know that one of the main activities that actually goes on in the Palestinian youth movement is self-education and public education too. So Palestinian youth for years have been putting together their own educational programs that are focused on their own needs, for themselves, and calling on and accessing and recording and working with the stories of their elders and working with their heritage and working with their revolutionary heritage. And so I think about projects that they've put together, like the publication and translation of the prison memoirs. They regularly do here in Montreal, but all over the world, all kinds of really important educational activities, and we've been so lucky here in Montreal to have so many of them.
Prison memoirs
of the name of the prisoner is out of my head. Wissam Rifai Rafidi. Am I saying the name? Yeah. So Wissam Rafidi. Okay. It's called The Trinity of Fundamentals, and it was recently released. And it was a project of the Palestinian Youth Movement where they collectively translated into English this work. So you probably know Stefan, I'm a translator, right? So I keep an eye on those things. And it was so exciting to see this really big, it's a big project, it's a long book, and it's not easy to translate from Arabic into English. And youth did it together, working with professional translators, but themselves translating it. And now they've been publicized it. They've been going around and doing readings, again, all over the world. It's been, on sale here in Montreal, and there have been discussions of it, again, here and across the world. So this is a movement that is both really local here, but also connected, as Tara was saying. So if we think about the encampment starting, it's really not a surprise that one of the first thing that pops up is a library. And if you go in there, like, that library is amazing. They have the best collection of books. We can do shout outs, right? So people have like brought together books. The Maktaba bookshop have donated books, but also people, individuals, profs, and just people brought books, and they said, here are the books for you people. And every time I go into the library, just pass by, there's like three people and they're reading, right? So, it's not just like a library that's there like, oh, we needed to make a library, but like young people who are in this encampment are learning and reading and so on. So, this, like, kind of the educational component is not just on the side, right? It's really like central to it, and it isn't central to it because, oh, these particular students at McGill and Concordia and the other students in Montreal came together because they think it's important. We see this in all of the encampments and in the larger movement in the world. So there's the library. They've also done, every day they've done programming. I mean, there's been rain, but they've done amazing programming as well. So there's just really a lot of educational space that's been opened.
Thanks so much for sharing all that. In terms of how the media has reported the encampment, to put it lightly, there's been a lot of like paternalistic vibes from mainstream media when it comes to like speaking about the encampment. Criminalization is a real thing. In terms of how reporting is structured, the terminology used, Breach Media has been really important in both creating space for social movement research, but and then sort of translating that into like articles and also investigations that really, in a lot of ways, can sort of undercut some of the claims of the powerful, in the Canadian context, to be for human rights or social justice. And I know that recently you've been really focused on Palestine. So, Martin, maybe you could talk about Breach Media and also, like, your work with many others in this project at this time. And it's a very interesting project because it really is a media project, but it also has a dialogue with social movements.
Sure. Thanks, Stefan. The Breach, has spent a lot of time the last several months trying to document the rampant anti-Palestinian bias in Canada's establishment media, which I think is certainly reflected in its coverage of what's happening in Gaza, but also we see it playing out in terms of how they cover the encampments that have sprung up across the country. The lack of concern and attention to Palestinian lives, the scale and scope of dehumanization, the prioritizing of Israeli spokespeople and their supporters. I mean, all of that has played out in terms of how they've covered the genocide in Gaza, but also how they've covered the encampments more recently. And I think what's been incredible to see as someone who's, tracked media coverage of Palestine the last few decades is just the incredible unmasking that, the students now and certainly the movement of the last several months has delivered. There's always been an absolute chasm between the realities on the ground, the dispossession, the destruction, and the myths propagated by the media here in Canada. But I just think it's never been so visible, that chasm. That's thanks in part to the education and the movement and, all the social media content, so much so that I think the U.S. Secretary of State just admitted a few days ago that they literally want to shut down TikTok because of all the incredible Palestine education that's happening on there. Mm. On our part, The Breach has been trying to document, including empirically, the scale of dehumanization and distortion that the establishment media across from television to the newspapers engage in. For instance, we did a study that looked line by line at every mention of death of both Israelis and Palestinians. And we found that it requires for papers like the National Post and the Globe and Mail 30 Palestinian deaths to merit a single mention of Palestinian death, whereas for every two Israeli deaths, there's a mention of Israeli death. It trickles down to the language that's used. Often on Twitter, this is often pointed out that, Palestinians die, whereas Israelis are killed. But also in the choice of language, there's been an inordinate asymmetry of death, obviously, that's been happening. The Western media will only use terms like massacre and slaughter to refer to the loss of Israeli life, not Palestinian life. And this isn't just an effect of unconscious structural bias. We got our hands on an internal CBC letter that made it clear that CBC consciously decides to not apply terms like massacre and slaughter to Palestinian death. So they told us, I can just quote from it directly, there was an internal letter basically from one of the senior managers who handles journalistic standards at CBC. And they said, consciously, yes, murderous, vicious, brutal refers to Hamas's attacks on Israelis. But when it comes to Israeli bombing of Palestinians, they prefer to use terms like intensive, unrelenting, and punishing. And, the more evocative and sympathy-generating terms don't apply to Palestinian deaths, quote, because Israel carries out its killings remotely instead of face-to-face. So this is a kind of moral and linguistic gymnastics that Western media engages in consciously to be able to, dehumanize and spread lies and deceit about what's happening before our eyes in Gaza.
Thank you, Martin. Breachmedia.ca. is the website. So please look up some of those reports. You know, at McGill for many years now, as both Tara and Michelle talked about, there's been like very important and meaningful campaigning from groups like Solidarity for Palestinian Human Rights and others to talk about Palestinian life and to talk about the reality of the occupation. This encampment is bringing this campaigning to a whole different level in terms of like the amount of focus on the encampment, the pressure also that students are feeling, you know, who are being part of this. So maybe if you could just talk a bit about, you know, your own work as a member of Solidarity for Palestinian Human Rights at McGill and how this encampment sort of is part of, you know, not just the last few weeks, but as part of like work that you've been doing on campus for some time.
For sure. So essentially SPHR McGill, you know, was established in 2002. So they've been leading this divestment campaign on McGill campus for 22 years, essentially. And the student body has, you know, constantly tried to go through different institutional mechanisms and all of these, you know, democratic, quote-unquote, processes that are in place through BDS motions and policies. And every single time, McGill administration has found a way to shut down the student body, despite the fact that there's a clear majority from the student body at McGill who is heeding these demands. They're calling on their administration very clearly, very loudly, that they cut academic and financial ties with the Zionist regime. And for the past 8 months, we've seen as student groups, you know, across Canada, across North America, mobilize and organize as a genocide unfolds, you know, in front of our very eyes. 40,000 people killed in a span of 8 months, and the Zionist regime has been able to perpetrate this genocide with impunity, with full backing from the U.S. and Canadian governments, but also, you know, with our with the complicity of our universities, including McGill University. So when you think about the fact that the demands of the student body are literally that our tuition money stops going into investing into weapons manufacturers, the very weapons being used against our people in Gaza as we speak. And so this encampment came, you know, it's like the culmination of, I mean, 22 years of a divestment campaign, but also the past 8 months of the student body, like organizing and mobilizing and disrupting and escalating. But also, we even tried to go through these democratic processes again. There was the fall 2023 referendum where we passed a policy, the policy against genocide in Palestine. It passed with a historic voter turnout, the largest voter turnout in the history of SMU. It passed with a 78% majority, and the ratification of that policy essentially was blocked by an injunction, by a court order. And so this encampment, I mean, it's the culmination of all of this organizing, but also essentially a rejection of this system that has never gotten us anywhere, because of the nature of the system. The system is designed to undermine and dismantle any anti-colonial of movement, essentially. And so this encampment came, you know, after this, but also in coordination with 140 universities across the world. There's an encampment on every continent, which is now calling and demanding these things, and using tactics that align with this broader movement. And what we see most importantly is, like, you know, you have students sleeping on the ground, in the mud, in the rain, in the cold. Mm-hmm. You know, students are not particularly enjoying these conditions, but they are determined and they are committed for one reason only, and it's because there is a genocide happening that has killed 40,000 people. We have all watched as you know, crimes occur in words that we can no longer describe, and it's being, you know, they're using our tuition money to fund this, and that is the only reason why these students are there, to call for divestment and in protest of an 8-month-old genocide that is being perpetrated.
Just for people listening, the SSMU is the Student Society of McGill University, which facilitated the that's the body through which these votes happen. How has it felt for you to be at the encampment? I'm sure there's a lot of feelings, but maybe share if you'd like to share something.
I mean, to see the development and the strength of the student movement over the past 8 months has for sure been like incredible. Again, this encampment is not just this encampment is not just like it didn't just pop out of a vacuum. Essentially, it's also the culmination of power that has been built. You know, historically, students have played a huge role in advancing social struggles, whether it be the fight for divesting from South Africa or even the anti-war movement in the U.S. That was primarily led by students. And this encampment is also a way to reassert the power that students have, and this is what we are seeing.
Tara?
I can't describe in words how I felt, I think, at the encampment. I mean, I used to be in SPHR when I was in my undergrad, and some of the students that had started at SPHR as I was leaving it are have really like built the power that Ram was talking about over the past 8 months and led it. And I'm just incredibly proud of these students, and also incredibly proud of having been part of SPHR a few years ago. I think looking at the youth here in Montreal, at McGill, Concordia, other universities, but also globally, like Michelle mentioned, can help us really understand the direction in which this struggle is going. We are not willing to compromise on our demands for a liberated Palestine. And also, we are willing to learn from, we are learning from previous regressions in anti-colonial and anti-imperialist movements. We are willing to resolve contradictions that, for example, the anti-war movement had brought up in North America. And through this movement, through this struggle, using Palestine as the compass, and using Palestine as the paradigm through which we can understand colonialism, imperialism, capitalism, not just within the borders of Palestine, or within the region even, but also internationally, we can progress beyond just the liberation of Palestine. And that's really what I think is really clear in this current moment, not just in this current moment, but has always been clear in the Palestinian movement, is that the liberation of Palestine will bring about a pivotal shift in the way that the world works. It will bring about the liberation of all oppressed peoples, of all colonized people. It will bring us closer to that moment where we can all be free. And we can see this very clearly with the demonstration of joint struggle between not just Palestinians, Arabs, Jewish students on campus, but all other people that are fighting for liberation from the same imperialist colonial entities that are funding and propagating the genocide of the Palestinian people.
Coming to terms with how a lot of the context that you both spoke about is really challenging, especially when it comes to, you know, there's a tie here, I think, between academic institutions and media institutions, right? Because in the last few years, there's been a meaningful shift where we see, at least on a discourse level, like institutions like McGill bringing in Indigenous elders to, you know, talk about, you know, whether it's Indigenous languages, or there's these sort of theatrical moves that are happening. That I think one thing I just wanted to mention quickly on that is I do think it's really a result of movements that these institutions are forced to sort of make this shift. You know, a lot of the inclusion and diversity rhetoric is coming from a radical origin in terms of like movements demanding representation. So there seems to be like this contradiction between the discourse of, like, you know, CBC, for example, has, you know, talked a lot about more inclusive journalism and you know, but then when it came down to it, starting in October, Palestinians were just totally dehumanized very often. So, Sarah, you just arrived, so maybe you could, you've been really involved in mobilizing on a Montreal-based level through the Palestinian youth movement. Yeah, so any thoughts about that? Because I know that the Palestinian youth movement has made a really meaningful effort to also connect with other campaigns and struggles for justice.
Yeah. Thank you, Stefan, for having me on. Really appreciate it. I think, you know, it's really interesting that, you know, you mentioned the administration, like, using, you know, the DEI language, bringing in Indigenous elders to make these statements. And I think, you know, like, one thing that we're seeing now is that the movement for Palestinian liberation is refusing to be co-opted, meaning that, you know, it has reached a level where in, you know, specific liberal or watered down language is no longer acceptable to use to understand it. You know, we can no longer use terms like Israeli apartheid, you know, it's occupation and it's genocide and it's settler colonialism. And I think that there's a few reasons for that. I think, you know, one is obviously what's happening on the ground, the really the brutality of, you know, the Israeli occupied, the Zionist regime, and how its real face is being shown, how it's being understood that this genocide, you know, is a culmination of 76 years of aggression. It's not an aberration of it. And, you know, also the resilience of our people in Gaza, its ability to continue to confront militarily and politically the Zionist regime. But I think, you know, it's also the ability for organizations in the far diaspora to be able to sharpen the contradictions that we're seeing happening right now. And this can only happen through organization and discipline. And, you know, those are, you know, the two of the most important factors when you think about the movement in the diaspora that allows it to be, to not be co-opted by, you know, these kind of facades or these smokes and, what do we call it? The smokes and
mirrors.
Yeah, exactly. So I think, you know, it's truly a watershed moment where, you know, I don't think it's even just become only about Palestine or liberating it from the river to the sea. But I think we're seeing a shift in the mass consciousness of the masses, which obviously political organizations play a really key role in. If you don't have political organizations that are able to sharpen these contradictions that are, yes, organic, and if you don't have political organizations that are able to politically orient the masses, whether it's in mass demonstrations or, you know, in community fundraisers, then you know, we're not able to, like, really absorb the moment and shift with this moment.
If somebody would have spoke to you a year ago about the scale of the Palestine solidarity protests that have happened, I think it would have been hard to imagine. How has it felt for you? I know that I've seen you chanting and giving a lot of speeches at these demonstrations.
Yeah, I was reflecting on that with some comrades recently, and I was specifically reflecting on November 4th, which to me was one of the most memorable, like, moments in the streets, because I think it was close to between 50 and 70,000 people on the streets of Montreal. It was an insane amount of people, and people were so connected to the moment. They, you know, were connected to the speakers, to the speeches that were happening, even the chanting that was all being done in Arabic. And you're seeing a sea of people that, you know, are Arab, Muslim, South Asian, Canadian, Quebecois. We've had people, you know, Haitians, Vietnamese, Congolese, and, like, it was just, and everybody, you know, either in perfect or broken Arabic is, you know,
chanting من المية للمية فلسطين عربية. Like this is an incredible moment, and I think it was one of those like pinch me moments where I just couldn't believe where the movement had gone, and I just couldn't believe, you know, that these are not people that are coming just because they're outraged. These are people that are could potentially be committed to the movement, and that could, you know, that are, I think, more willing to sacrifice for the movement and for the cause.
I remember seeing a sign from a protest around that time that said Cambodians for Palestine, yeah. And that was just beautiful, just seeing all the different communities that were part of this process. Trying to, like, create space in institutions to tell these stories and to, like, sort of have an openness to hear from, you know, political activists who are organizing for Palestinian life right now is not simple. Norma, you have, like, really made a big effort over the last years to create space for Palestinian students and to create, you know, context to support them. I think sometimes people might, you know, follow, like, the encampment action or these major protests and sort of just imagine that they just happen. And obviously that's not the case. There's, like, a lot of people like you who are doing a lot of work to lift up and create space for these voices. So how has it been, like, for you to try to, like, critically engage with Concordia University, where you're based, and to, like, you know, and create space for academics to speak out? Maybe just talk a bit about that process, academics for Palestine at Concordia, and you know, people often think that the student movement maybe is, or the shorthand is that it's students, but it's also faculty, it's also university workers, it's also community members.
Thanks, Stefan, and thanks for having me here. The organization Academics for Palestine Concordia emerged actually around 2017, but even the history of that goes back a bit further, and it really, in many ways, was sparked by a series of bombardments on Gaza, and the reality that while faculty were, for the most part, doing things like signing petitions and supporting student actions, that there wasn't an actual space to be more proactively involved. And so after the 2014, in particular, bombardment, there was a view, and this was also a cross-campus coordination with McGill primarily, that we needed a space apart maybe from the SPHRs, this Solidarity for Palestinian Human Rights undergraduate organizations, to mobilize other members of the university community. And so that was the kind of trigger for that. And what it also sought to do was to think about the multifaceted ways in which our universities are implicated in the Israeli settler colonial regime and propping it up. We were also motivated by the call for BDS, the Boycott, Divestment, and Sanctions call, and thinking about trying to identify, as much as the students have been suggesting, identify, you know, disclose, divest in terms of actual investments, but also to think about what kind of existing research partnerships are there among faculty and among, researchers at the institutions, and to disclose the way in which universities, Israeli universities, are themselves complicit in propping up the regime, the settler colonial and violent regime. And so that was kind of the spark for that. And, one of the things that's happened more recently is since October 7th, there has been a mushrooming of interest on the part of faculty. It was actually harder to mobilize faculty interest. And so that's been exciting to see, the growing interest, and so that we could coordinate our resources and efforts more forcefully.
So there's so much to talk about, and it's really great that we can have this space together. I just want to rewind to the point of the sort of contradictions in the discourse around institutions, around, like, inclusion and diversity, which are important things. And I think that there can be, like, obviously, like, a critique of the way that liberal institutions, you know, are sort of adopting this discourse, but then criminalizing activism. So Michelle and or Martin, I thought of sort of like the role that the breach plays in terms of sort of pointing out those contradictions in the Canadian media landscape. And you talked about the research that you did about how Palestinian life was treated. And Michelle, I know that it's been complicated to try to create space for actual critical engagement on Palestine at McGill. So maybe we'll start with Michelle and then go to Martin. Yeah.
Speaking about critical engagement with Palestine at McGill, from kind of following off of what Norma was saying about the organizing of professors, is that sort of what you were thinking about? Yeah, so as, you know, kind of picking up on just what Norma was saying, so we've really worked together as faculty a lot with our colleagues across the different campuses. And for many years, we worked in a Montreal-based group that was largely Anglophone, so largely Concordia and McGill, but also with teachers in Cégeps and a few of our colleagues at Université de Montréal and UQAM. And we're still doing that. And as Norma says, it's really been growing and growing. But it is difficult in university spaces often to do this because precisely of the structures that are put mm-hmm. in place that Tara spoke about, mm-hmm. that the SPHR student here talked about, that Norma talked about. The structures are set up not to be able to do this. So whereas we have done so much of this work, it's often not through the official structures, but finding ways to do to work along with it. And so it's precisely the kind of organizing and meeting people and knowing people like that allows us to be able to put things together. So you know that there's a resource person like Norma at Concordia who does a certain thing, and we can connect and reach out to her, because we have done as professors a lot of things, but we've done them together with each other and together with students and together with other community members, as you pointed out also, Stefan, right? It's not that the university, you know, is actually apart from the community. I mean, the university is part of the community, and it can keep trying to put itself apart from the community. It can have gates. It can have gates even that it closes, like we saw the other day. But at the end of the day, if you're really doing the work that a university is there for, which is educating and opening people's minds will be educated and open, and they'll find ways to overcome it. And one way we've seen is in this encampment, right? So we're actually seeing it do that thing that we all talk about. But we have been, you know, slowly over time finding ways to build up, you know, education and also, like Norma was saying, mobilization within structures that are set up to work against us. So whereas the EDI structures that are in place at McGill often literally, specifically, and explicitly exclude Palestine and Palestinians, we still gather together and find ways to work on it and find ways to challenge it. We find each other, we come together, and we challenge. But the actual structures that are put in place again and again and again have failed, obviously students, but also faculty. They've failed at Palestinian faculty and workers. So, you know, there's a strong critique, but there is a hopeful moment in it, I think, when people are coming together in the different ways to challenge it.
I think about the Student Wellness Hub, which is funded by the Rossi family, which I'm involved in the Immigrant Workers Center. And, you know, this is, you know, a family that systemically exploits through the Dollarama warehouse thousands and thousands of people. And there's so many contradictions like that, but also important to point out the campaigns and the work that people are doing at a community-based level to address them. Martin, did you have any thoughts about the sort of like media landscape and sort of thinking critically? It's one thing to critique the media, and that's important. Another thing is to present viable alternatives, which is Breach Media is doing, and that's pretty awesome.
Thanks, Stefan. And there have been others as well. The Maple is another outlet that has done incredible work documenting the the Liberal government's, you know, various deceits about arms transfers to Israel and Briar Patch. There are groups and outlets in Toronto like The Grind that have done great documentation of street protests and the police crackdown on Palestinian solidarity. So, yeah, I mean, ultimately, though, my faith is not in media outlets, but in movements. I think the only thing that can ultimately force the hand of media and change their coverage is when there is an incredible upswell of organizing, as we're seeing now. I mean, I think even of the encampment here, I would have never imagined that outlets like the CBC, the Gazette, the Globe would be doing entire articles scrutinizing McGill's investments. And that's a direct result of the campaign. You know, I mean, there was a... and also I would say, too, that one of the things that has been heartening for me as a Jewish leftist has been that the weaponization of anti-Semitism, which, of course, advocates for Palestinian liberation have had to deal with for decades, you know, a very powerful weapon, has never been weaker. And it's been heartening to see Jewish advocates for a free Palestine getting airtime, whereas in the past, you know, media would as a reflex go to the Sijas and the B'nai Briths and the Simon Wiesenthals, and now, you know, finally they're starting to go to the IJVs and
Independent Jewish Voices.
Independent Jewish Voices, excuse me, Jews Against Genocide, as well as starting to give platforms and more airtime to Palestinian voices, though that is, of course, always rife with double standards. We have a piece coming out actually next week by a former CBC producer who quit over their Palestinian coverage in the last few months. And it's just this kind of relentless documentation of the double standards applied to Palestinian voices as opposed to Israeli or pro-Israeli ones. Mm-hmm. But incredibly heartening to see the shifts that are slowly happening, thanks to movement mm-hmm. activity. Obviously, that these institutions won't change fundamentally. It's in their makeup. But as long as the movements are powerful and growing, that will ultimately lead to more and more positive changes, more accurate coverage, more voice time for advocates. So it's good to see.
Thanks so much for sharing that. So we have about 10 minutes left, under 10 minutes, and then you know, we'll have another time for a discussion. But I also wanted to thank Transistor Radio for giving space today for this broadcast. And we are going to play a song selection from Transistor Radio to go out. But we have about 5 minutes to maybe talk a bit about where we're at with the camp, because that's also why we're here. So maybe I'll go to you, member of Solidarity for Palestinian Human Rights at McGill. Maybe the idea is that, okay, well, there's a certain peak of interest that happened when the camp was set up, but people are still there and are still needing support. So maybe just describe where things are at right now, and also ways that people could support or things that, you know, any thoughts about that? Yeah.
I mean, this encampment is reaching its second week, and energy and morale are still incredibly high, despite the fact that we've had very rainy days. The community has been consistently showing up. Just to comment also on what others were saying about this turning into a community space. That's where the term Popular University for Gaza came from. It's in the absence of a space for these people of consciousness to aggregate on our university and be able to you know, uphold very basic principles such as, you know, liberation. This is the student body reclaiming their university and establishing a popular space which emphasizes the mass character of this movement. And this is what we're seeing. The weekly rallies that have been happening are all aggregating on McGill campus. Thousands of people from the community, youth and elderly from different backgrounds, are all supporting the Palestinian Student Front and heeding these demands within this broader context of demanding an end to Western complicity. This Saturday, there is a Nakba rally that will commemorate 76 years since the Nakba It will probably also aggregate at McGill campus, again, heeding the same demands. So what we're seeing, you know, these encampments are not just, again, popping out of a vacuum. They're part of this broader movement. They're an extension to a national liberation struggle. And we see the student body being, you know, in its second week, still being incredibly committed and determined to sustaining and potentially expanding this encampment if their demands are not met. They have been very clear about this. You know, people might have heard about how McGill administration has reached out to the student body to engage in conversation about these demands. Students from the McGill encampment have submitted a detailed and clear list of their demands to McGill administration in a closed meeting. McGill administration has yet to come back with a concrete proposal that responds materially to the demands of the students within an appropriate timeline, of course. And what we have seen is the students, again, sustaining this encampment and expanding it to reiterate that, you know, they're here to stay until their demands are met materially.
Sarah, any thoughts about the importance of the broader Montreal community still supporting this encampment?
Yeah, I mean, I think Romo touched on this, but, you know, I think what we are seeing right now about the student encampments, which is really, really incredible, is that it is mass in character. So we're talking about, you know, programming that is happening every day. We're talking about community members that, you know, like aunties that are like cooking for 100 people in order to support the students. You know, this is part of the, you know, national liberation movement here in the far diaspora. And, you know, the masses here in Montreal in the Arab and Muslim community are going to continue to rally behind the students.
Respect. Thank you, Sarah. Tara, last word.
I mean, I don't think I have anything to add. You guys pretty much explained it perfectly. But I will say that I really believe that these students will make a change, and that the youth in the Palestinian youth movement in Montreal has been doing amazing work in conjunction with the student groups. And I think that it's pretty clear to everyone that not just on McGill campus, but otherwise, there will be no rest until things materially change. Until Palestine is free, until our prisoners are free, until the 17-year-long air, land, and sea blockade on Gaza is completely lifted, and until all of Palestinian land is liberated.
Thank you, everybody, for your time today on this discussion here at CKUT. Thank you to Hamza, who's documenting it, too. And King, would you like to share a bit about this piece that you selected for today? You could just grab any microphone. We have it up here. It's called Until We Are All Free.
Yeah, I mean, it's so basically like it's a song about like what's happening right now in Palestine and like how it's related to, you know, colonialism and everything. Like, I used to be very involved in the Black Lives Matter movement, and what we're seeing happen right now is the same thing, you know? It's just the same thing to a different group of people. And so the song says that it's like, nobody will be free until we're all free, and kind of like drawing parallels behind, like, you know, between like all of these issues. And yeah.
Thank you so much. And thanks again to Transistor Radio for the space today, and to all the guests for being here. The archive will be up on soundcloud.com/freecityradio. CKUT's website is ckut.ca. I'm Stefan Christoph. We'll continue to do coverage on CKUT of the encampment. This broadcast will also be shared on some different campus community radio stations throughout different cities. So stay tuned for that, and thanks again to everybody for being here.
Just a kid. kid trying to be, when will you see? Yeah. From Gaza to Gattaca, we keep it radical. West Tony's morals, I think, are sabbatical. Out of this catapult, slinging my shot, like it or not.
A child is playing in a rubble heap, with dreams are buried deep and her mother slowly weeps. Tonight he'll try to sleep under the stars, looking at the moon through the many holes in the walls. He'll try to cry to let it out, he'll try to fly, close his eyes and head for the clouds. He gotta try, try his best to make it out, cause he survived, but the rest of the fam did not, yeah. His sister once beside him, now is a ghost in his dreams. Dado used to stand tall, is now torn at the seams. And yeah, his mother brings peace, but this war is all she's seen, yeah. She holds on to the key that her elders left behind, key to the family house that is closed, yeah, oh, so far. And all she can do now is picture life beyond the wall. From Paris to the Bronx, from the river to the sea, how you will be free until we are free. From Gaza to Ferguson, we hear the people's plea now. To the reserves and through the burning tree, but you will be free until we are free. Whatever happens to them, it also happens to me, cause but you will be free until we are free. And there's this little black girl who walks the school with grace. A world that who she is will make her life a maze. She dreams of being a lawyer, maybe arguing courts. But she's also got fear that her life will be short, cause she's seen on TV all the kids shut down in their prime. Mothers weeping the loss of a child. Orange waters pouring with intent to take lives, yeah. Reunite her home, a soul taken too soon. A Sunny Hook and Parkland turning schools into tombs. She's navigating a world where being free is no guarantee. She stands tall and every night looks at the sky. She knows she's not alone whenever she prays to the stars. And like Angelo told her, no matter what, still she will rise, yeah. From Paris to the Bronx, from the river to the sea, body will be free until we are free. From Gaza to Ferguson, we hear the people's plea that body will be free until we are free. From Flint to the reserves and through the burning tree, body will be free until we are free. Whatever happens to them, it also happens to me, cause body will be free until we are free. From Paris to the Bronx, from the river to the sea, body will be free until we are free. From Gaza to Ferguson, we hear the people's plea that body will be free until we are free. From Flint to the reserves and through the burning trees.